In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, the Creator and Sustainer of the Universe, peace and blessings upon His servant, the Messenger of Muhammad forever. Ameen. I greet you with a greeting that is common in Islam, our usual greeting on the Islam and Focus program, Assalamu Alaikum, which means peace be unto you. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we have our 12th program in our series dealing with the economic system of Islam. We'll be continuing our discussion of production and productivity, and our topic for today will deal with the prohibition of riba, or interest. I have joining me on the program as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
In the last few programs in our series, we've been addressing mainly the question of motivation to productivity from the point of view of the conceptual and historical perspectives. Before addressing the question of interest, which is our topic for today, are there specific measures that you can suggest to help maintain and improve on productivity?
And beyond the broad guidance that has been...
Right.
Yes, indeed. In fact, you can say, for example, that Islam's attitude towards the respect of the right of private ownership that we have discussed in one of the earlier programs in this series is also part of inducing production and productivity, because it responds to people's instinctive need to possess something and try to invest it and make it grow. In one of the earlier program also, maybe you can make a cross-reference here, the inducement that Islam provides to work, its teaching against laziness, its respect of all types of honorable labors, manual or otherwise, is also one aspect of inducing productivity. We have seen, of course, as you indicated in the previous programs, how the ideological and religious orientation also of a true Muslim would be of being productive in fulfillment of his responsibility before God, above all, in addition, of course, to responsibility before humanity and general welfare of mankind. But in addition to this, we find that Islam has taken also more specific measures in the area of production and productivity to make sure that resources are properly utilized. That includes teaching pertaining to land use, things pertaining to the prohibition of interest or usury, also the system of zakah in Islam, one of the pillars of Islam, or charity, institutionalized charity, if you will, are all factors which seem to work also in harmony with the previous measures that we discussed before.
Mm-hmm. Well, could we have a quick look at the question of land use? How does Islam induce its use?
Okay, of course, needless to emphasize the importance of the land being one of the major productive resources in almost any country or any location. There are perhaps, let's say, three or four basic regulations pertaining to land use which Islam provides. One is to give the government the right to dispose of what you might call crown land, land which is owned, you know, by the government, and to give it to individuals who are going to make better use of it or make it productive, individuals or bodies, you know, corporations or whatever, who can make use of this land. So that, again, encourage use, proper use. A second interesting teaching in Islam that comes on the basis of the authority of the teaching of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, as narrated in Abu Dawood and other authorities, is to induce people to reform land which is not tillable, or land which is barren.
Mm-hmm.
To reform it and do some work on it. In fact, the Prophet said that if a person get to a piece of land like that which is not used and make it usable, it is his. He can use it. It becomes his property. And that's a strong inducement.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the condition is that this land should not be owned already by someone else. Number two, that in doing so, the principle of equal opportunity for everybody should be open. So you don't say, I'll take the entire land of the country, for example, and reform it. You have to give a chance to others also who may wish to use the same privilege. And of course, an interesting third condition, which relates to your question directly, is that if a person in Islamic law reformed this land but does not use it for 3 years, he may lose that right. And we're talking about, again, land reformed by the person. So he's got up to 3 years. If he doesn't use it or make it productive, then it can be given to someone else, and that, again, prevents resources from being idle. Another or a third teaching, that even in land which is not reformed, just regular situation, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said that if one of you have any piece of land, he should either cultivate it, or if he's not able to, he should give it to someone who is able to cultivate it. So again, that's not only just a matter of charity, but also overall benefit in society. And firstly, even if the person doesn't wish to do it just on a purely charitable basis because he can't use it, there is also something in Islamic law called muzara'a, which is a sort of partnership, whereby if you're not able to use the land yourself or you lack the skill, you can agree with someone else to work on that land, and you could contribute something to the cost of cultivation, mm-hmm. and agree on some kind of crop sharing after the crop is harvested. So these are all examples of measures to keep the land in proper use. Some of us might think of this as really very advanced or very modern type of measures, but in fact, 1,500 years ago, these were enshrined in the Islamic teaching.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, coming to the question of interest, I think we've indicated in some of our earlier programs that the prohibition of interest in Islam is not contrary to productivity.
Yes.
The common notion, however, is that it's impossible, particularly here in the West, the common notion is that it's impossible to conduct any kind of meaningful economic life without resorting to interest. How would you respond to somebody who held that particular point of view?
Well, it is common to hear that statement, but in my humble understanding, it is a common myth also. To say that it is impossible to have an advanced economy not based on interest and interest dealing. Well, we have seen in previous programs unequivocal evidence how Islamic civilization and progress has flourished in different parts of the world under different cultural circumstances for hundreds of years. And we have seen again the great advancement not only in science but in agriculture, industry, trade and commerce. And these activities were all based on non-interest situation. They were not really on an interest-based type of structure. How did they progress and flourish without interest? It is interesting to notice that during the caliphate of Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, that's nearly the about 90 years after Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that when they collected the charity from North Africa, they did not find enough poor who are in need of that charity. And you might recall in one previous program sometimes back, we said that the command or the instruction of the caliph was to use this money to buy slaves and set them free because there was no poor really in need. Well, where do we find that in the 20th century? Any even advanced, technologically advanced country in the world with very prosperous and affluent economy that cannot find enough people who are asking for charity or need. In fact, the contrary is true. We find problems with the funds available for social security not being able to meet the needs of those who are in need. I think this is an irrefutable evidence that you could have a very, very flourishing economy without necessarily having to resort to interest. Well, if there's any reason why we should not have a partnership and participation in profit and loss on equal grounds without interest, if there's any reason why can't we have that, this is the question really that should be raised. It's not always why not why not have interest. The question is, why do we have to have interest? Is it really an absolute necessity? But in any case, from the Islamic standpoint, in Islamic law, its interest is not an acceptable alternative to establish a flourishing economy. Mm-hmm. It's not needed either.
Well, now, it's not only Islam that has prohibited interest. Isn't that right? There have been other religious communities as well who have been against the riba or interest.
Oh, yes, that's true. In fact, for example, for most viewers, we would be familiar with the Bible. And if you refer, for example, to the book of Deuteronomy in chapters 23, particularly verses 20 and 21, we find that the instructions there is quite clear that the Israelite or the Jew is not supposed to lend money or get interest on loans from another Jew. The principle is there, even though, of course, the difficulty that a Muslim would have with a text like that is that it seems to imply that you can't take interest from a Gentile. But in the case of Islam, the prohibition applies to both, Jew and Gentile, Muslim and non-Muslim, both can be under the same regulation. In the book of Matthew, for example, in chapters 21, in especially verses 12 and 13, we are told about Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, when he entered into Jerusalem and went to the temple, and that he threw away or pushed the tables of the money changers. And in fact, according to the book of Matthew, he was accusing them of turning the temple of God into what he called den of thieves, as has been translated. In the Reformation movement, we find that Luther has called upon Christians during this Reformation period to go back to the original teaching of the Bible by prohibiting interest. In fact, he wrote a little booklet on the subject, and he considered it unlawful and contrary to the will of God and contrary to reason even to deal in interest. Even in some philosophies, not only religion, we find that people like Aristotle, for example, made an interesting remark that unlike animals can beget animals, but he says money cannot beget money. In other words, money should be only regarded as a measure of value, but money is not a commodity itself, that you can get interest on. Notice that some of these views preceded Islam, some even came after Islam, like Luther's call and the formation, move was after Islam came. So the idea of prohibition of interest is not it's not unique to Islam. It seems to be a basic moral or ethical law, really, throughout history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I wonder if you perhaps could give us some indication of the authority for the prohibition of interest in Islam. Is it based on the Quran, or is it based on opinion?
Well, it is based on the Quran, on the prophetic tradition, and the consensus of learned jurists throughout Islamic history. The first thing to notice here before I go further is to reiterate what I mentioned earlier, that the prohibition here is not just between Muslims. It's prohibition that applies to everybody, because whatever is regarded as inequitable and unjust is applicable to Muslims and non-Muslims as well, mm-hmm. at least from an Islamic standpoint. But the Quran, for example, in chapter 4, in verse 161, indicates that one of the inequities of the Israelites is that they took usury, though they were forbidden from taking it. So that's a threat or a kind of warning to Muslims not to follow the same kind of line or violation. In chapter 30 in the Quran, verse 39, which, by the way, is a Makki chapter that is revealed in Mecca before even an Islamic state was established in Medina, we find again for prohibition of usury, and that this is something that would not be accepted by God or rewarded by him. In chapter 3 in the Quran, in verses 130 and 131, it makes an analogy between avoiding usury and avoiding hellfire, which is quite a serious kind of analogy. But perhaps one of the more dramatic verses in the Quran about the usury is the verse that says, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا اتَّقُوا اللَّهَ وَذَرُوا مَا بَقِيَ مِنَ الرِّبَى إِن كُنْتُم مُؤْمِنِينَ فَإِن لَمْ تَفْعَلُوا فَأْذَنُوا بِحَرْبٍ مِنَ اللَّهِ وَرَسُولِهِ. The translation of the meaning is that all you who believe, fear God and give up what remains of your demand for usury if you are indeed believers. If you do it not, notice here, take notice of a war from God and his apostle. And who can stand a war? Whose adversary in that war is God and his messenger? It makes it quite really clear that usury is a great evil that one should really keep away. Of course, unfortunately, in our day and age, it seems that this widespread of use of usury or interest had made it so easy for us to look at it very lightly as something which is acceptable simply because it's so widespread. But the same kind of principle has also been echoed in the prophetic traditions. Perhaps one of the more dramatic ones, as narrated in Muslim, Ahmad, Abu Dawood, and Tirmidhi, in which the Prophet says that the curse of God would be on usury, the people who take it, the people who give it, the people who write even the usury contract or witness this kind of contract, which shows that any participation even in promoting interest dealings is forbidden for the Muslim. The same kind of pictures were mentioned by the Prophet as some of the scenes he saw in the night of Ascension, where he saw again people who deal in usury in kind of terrible punishments. But perhaps one of the things that relate to our being so accustomed to usury is a prophetic tradition narrated in Ahmad, in which he says that there will come a time when people will deal in usury. So the companions asked the Prophet, he said, everybody? He said, well, even those who are not directly dealing with usury will still get the dust of it or still get some touch of it. That's what we are today. So widespread, even though it is not really neither necessary or right from the point of view of Islamic law.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are some Muslims who try to justify interest on a number of grounds. It might be helpful for us to spend a few minutes examining some of the grounds that they put forward as well. First is some claim that Islam only forbade the usury. And that usury is different from interest. Mm-hmm. Perhaps it shows that they don't understand the use of the Arabic term, but could you comment a bit on people who hold that view?
You see, some of the confusion about this particular question is that somebody would go to the translation of the meaning of the Quran in English, go to the dictionary, and find the meaning of the word as if this is the original word of the. As we know, the Quran is revealed in Arabic. Mm-hmm. Now, it is true that if you check the English dictionary, you find that the term usury means excessive or illegal kind of interest. Yes. And they say, well, that means modest interest is different. Yes, but that's in the English term. But the Quran is not revealed in English, that's the problem. See? The original word that appears in the Quran is riba. If you transliterate that, it reads like R-I-B-A, riba. And riba in Arabic doesn't mean excessive usury. Riba in Arabic simply means anything in excess, which means anything in excess of the principal, capital, whether it's a small or unfair or unlawful, still, it is riba, it is interest. So from the Arabic standpoint, from the language in which the Quran was revealed, this kind of distinction is not really valid. From the practical point of view, again, it doesn't make much difference because based on the Arabic definition, whether that increment is small or big, it is regarded as riba. It's either big interest, small interest, but what is forbidden in Islam is interest, period, regardless of the magnitude. And in fact, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, did warn Muslims that towards the end of the days or later days, people would do the things which are unlawful, but give it different names. And we find that in usury as we find it in other fields. Mm-hmm. We find, for example, indecency and lack of proper cover and nudity and all this is sometimes called art.
Yes.
We find intoxicants that destroy the person's mind and health is sometimes called spirits, as if it's something, you know, spiritual to drink or to take drugs. By the same token, this usury, which is regarded as wrong Islamically from the ethical point of view as well as practical point of view, is again giving a different name. No, it's not usury, it's interest. Well, what's the difference? It's basically one and the same. Different names, really, that are given to it, at least on the basis of the terminology used in the Quran.
Mm-hmm. Well, clarify this point a little bit further. Some claim that that one verse in the Quran speaks only of excessive interest, implying that once again that reasonable interest is satisfactory. how would you respond to that claim?
Okay, first of all, one has to refer to that claimed evidence and see whether it really stands scrutiny. The verse that's usually cited to support this kind of view is in chapter 3, and that's verse 130, which says, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا لَا تَأْكُلُوا الرِّبَى أَضْعَافًا مُضَعَفًا, which means, O you who believe, do not devour usury, doubled and multiplied, but fear God, that you may prosper. And they say, well, it says, أَضْعَافًا مُضَعَفًا, multiplied, you know, twice, thrice, and more. So we say, all right, well, if the interest is 200% or 300%, it's unlawful, but if it's reasonable and modest, it is not, it's not unlawful. But what don't forget here is that if you refer to the terminology used in the Quran, it says, do not devour usury. It doesn't say devour the principle. And usury can easily be multiplied twice, thrice, and 10 times. If you're paying an interest rate of, let's say, even 7% a year, something which is rare, you can't find that now, but suppose even 7%. Well, if you have a loan for 5 years, and assuming that you're not making any payment until the end of the 5 year, the fifth year, the interest is multiplied almost five times, see, because you have to pay 7% a year, so by the end of the 5 years, it's 35. So if you look only at the additional amount that you have to pay the interest, it is multiplied so many times. Furthermore, if you look at it, let's say, as a monthly interest, the same problem is there. It may sound like a modest 0.75% per month, but the next month it would be 1.5%. By the end of the year, it would be 12 times as much as 0.75%. And that meets the criteria mentioned in this verse that it is multiplied. It is true that interest is multiplied so many times. It's not unusual, even if it appears modest, a few percentage point here and there. But even then, if you look at it in terms of the long-term investment, like people buying homes, if you buy a home at even 8, 10% interest rate over 25 years, you can go and get the tables and find out how much total you'll be paying by the end of the 25th year before you own the house.
Mm-hmm.
It would be at least 2 to 3 times the original value or the original cost of the house. So even the principal here has been multiplied, not even the addition. So what we're saying here basically is that when the Quran speaks or uses the term doubled and multiplied, it is, as qualified jurists say, it is not a condition for being forbidden, but a description of a bad state of affairs.
Yes.
Well, to explain that legalistic rule, it's just like if somebody says brutal murder is wrong. Well, it doesn't mean that murder which is not brutal is okay.
Yes.
It's simply that you're making murder look very bad, really look terrible in the eyes of people, but it doesn't mean that other types of murder which is not too brutal is okay. So in addition to this, of course, why pick that particular verse, even though it doesn't mean what some may want it to mean to them, and leave all the conclusive texts in the Quran and prophetic tradition which did not make a distinction between small or big interest? Intendant.
Well, now, how about those who claim that interest dealings are just the business like any other kind of commercial dealing, and as such should not be subject to any prohibition?
Not a new question, in fact. Some might be surprised that the very same question that they raised was raised also by the unbelievers during the days of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. It's a very, very frequent question. I'm glad that you brought it forth. In fact, the Quran deals with it in chapter 2, verse 275 on. ذَلِكَ بِأَنَّهُمْ قَالُوا إِنَّمَا الْبَيْعُ مِثْلُ الرِّبَى وَأَحَلَّ اللَّهُ الْبَيْعَ وَحَرَّمَ الرِّبَى. It says that those people who devour usury, I will say that usury is just like trade or commerce. But the verse replies, no, but God has made trade lawful an interest or usury unlawful. So the same kind of analogy was made in the past. But in addition to the response in terms of the text of the Quran, economically speaking, even there seems to be sometimes a mix between money and capital. And some people use the term money and capital interchangeably, mm-hmm. which is not necessarily true. Money could be used to buy so many things. You can use money to buy services, you can buy consumer goods, cars, TV sets, whatever, by this money. Or you can buy equipment, which would be regarded as an asset or capital. So to say that money and capital are synonymous is wrong in itself. And as we indicated earlier, money is not a commodity in itself. It is a measure of value.
Mm-hmm.
So, but if you convert that money that you want to invest in a form of machinery, assets, or other equipment, then you deserve, Islamically, and there's nothing wrong with that Islamically, you deserve some income or some kind of reward. But that reward would not be just a fixed type of interest, but something that would vary with the kind of profit or contribution that your asset or your equipment adds to the profitability of any particular enterprise. So the two are not necessarily synonymous, but the load is different from interest.
Yeah. Well, to continue on with some of the other grounds that some people use to try to justify interest, some have suggested that what Islam prohibits is the charging of interest on consumption loans, especially loans to needy persons.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any basis to that claim?
There is no basis for that either. There are a number of reasons for that statement. First of all, it has been already indicated that, etymologically speaking, the meaning of the word riba means increment, whether that increment applies to consumption loans or so-called production type of loans. And those who say that, they claim that the Arabs before Islam, that's where the Quran was revealed first, even though it was not intended only for them, but they say the context of it was that people should not really charge interest to people who borrow because they are needy, because they want to eat, for example. And what they seem to forget is that the life of the Arabs before Islam was very, very simple life. An Arab at that time did not borrow in order to buy a late model car or a color TV or a video cassette recorder or anything of that sort, as we do today, and that's what causes so many people to keep borrowing and having charge cards and all that. The Arabs used to live in a very simple way. They eat mainly dates and bread, you know. Bread even was regarded as a kind of luxury item. They drink milk from their goats. Well, it's very difficult, really, to say that the Arabs before Islam used to borrow a lot to buy dates or goat milk. It doesn't seem to be logical at all. What seems to be more logical, perhaps, is that Mecca and Medina, Mecca where the Quran was revealed first, and At-Ta'if, for example, a nearby city, were commercial cities.
Yes.
That's one thing. Secondly, in the farewell pilgrimage, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in his speech, made it very clear that all kind of usury or interest is forbidden, and he said one of them is the usury that was charged by my uncle Al-Abbas. Now, historically, the uncle of the Prophet was not someone who was going to borrow to buy dates or milk or goat milk. He was a reasonably rich person. He used to provide food, free food, for pilgrims. He was a merchant, so the loans that the Prophet is talking about here were production loans, that loans to use in commerce and trade, and then simply, people would be charging him some extra for this. So we're talking here really about commercial or production loans that the Prophet was dealing with. The fact that some of the verses in the Quran speaks about prevention of interest and then talks about charity does not necessarily mean that it's only in the case of loan, because charity in Islam means also to avoid things that are forbidden. After all, the Prophet says to smile in the face of your brother is a charity.
Mm-hmm. Well, our time for this episode of Islam in Focus has gone. We want to invite you back next week and we'll continue our discussion. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
Allahu Akbar. الله.